Chapter 4. Relationship Status and Power. An unwritten cross-cultural rule is that lower-status people don't give commands to those of higher status. They thus soften their language when making a request. For example, a flight attendant will invite passengers to take their seats rather than to sit down. Common sense and research align with a positive correlation between status and politeness. When you ask a favor or make a request of someone, the language is calibrated to the size of the request and the power gap between the two people. Lower status, or overall insecurity, is revealed through the degree to which a person feels it's necessary to modify her requests. We do this through any one or a combination of 10 mechanisms. 1. Just add please. Pass the salt becomes please pass the salt. 2. Turn the request into a question. Close the door becomes can you close the door? 3. Use upspeak, meaning a rise in intonation at the end of the sentence. Close the door becomes close the door? 4. Minimize or hedge the request. Can you stay later? Becomes, can you stay just a little bit later? Or, perhaps you might stay a bit longer? 5. Apologize for the request. I need you to come in early. Becomes, I'm sorry to do this, but... 6. Ask the request indirectly. What time is it? Becomes, do you have the time? 7. Frame the request as a rule. Rather than make a request, the person is apprised of the standing policy. Stop diving in the pool becomes diving is not allowed. 8. State the facts. Take out the garbage becomes the garbage is full. 9. Present the possibility. Put your credit card in now becomes you can put in your card now. And 10. Ask if you can ask. Instead of making the request, start with, can I ask you a favor? Asking if you can ask removes the threat entirely and is illustrated in the following story. A good friend of mine is the head fundraiser for a large nonprofit organization. Each day he asks people for hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of dollars. Occasionally, he will go back to the same donor, someone who just gave money a mere month ago, and ask for another donation. While some people think this is an unusual practice, he always develops great relationships with these donors. What is his secret to avoid offending them? Simple. He doesn't ask for another donation. Instead, he asks whether he can ask for a donation. Do you see the difference in the dynamics? If he were to ask for money outright, he would put the other person on the defensive and risk coming across as ungrateful, thus creating a power struggle. But by asking whether he can ask, he puts the donor in control and, as such, eliminates the donor's defenses. Why? Because the donor can simply say no to the question without having to say no to the request for money. If the absence of a linguistic softener signals higher status, actual or perceived, combining two or more softeners into a single request is equally illuminating of lower status or of a submissive personality. Take, for instance, a doubly solicitous request wind-up. I'm so sorry to trouble you, but could I possibly ask if you might... There's no missing the fact that the speaker is managing up here. One's acknowledgement can also assume many forms, ranging from an overly polite, thank you so much, to ungrateful silence. No discussion of the communication of status and power in conversation would be complete without mentioning the potential to misread the use of the royal we. It may be indicative of a higher status individual who wants to avoid a tacit me versus you dynamic. The lady of the house who tells the cleaning help, we need to wash the floors, has little intention of getting out the mop and pail herself. Likewise, the drill sergeant in basic training rebukes a trainee with, "Drop and give me 50, not, "Let's drop. We need to do some push-ups here." However, a lower status person may also use this language to avoid a direct inquiry or request. A secretary may, for instance, ask his boss, "Can we wrap up work by 5 o'clock? Rather than, "Can I leave at 5 o'clock? Or, "Will you be done by 5 o'clock so I can go home?" Silence is golden. Another unwritten rule of power is that the less you have to say or do to gain cooperation, the more control you have. To wit, we would expect to observe a higher-ranking officer gesture to another officer or cadet to move, stop, sit down, and the like, without ever saying a word. Likewise, with a wave of the hand, the police stop traffic, and with a finger raised in the air, the judge silences the attorney. To exert influence over another, to move him or to stop him, is to exercise status, and the less pressure you need to apply to gain cooperation, the more power you wield and the more control you have. Emotionally healthy lower status people are less likely to issue nonverbal commands to those of higher status. Could you imagine a new recruit in basic training holding up his hand to the drill sergeant as if to say, "Wait"? This rule is observable across multiple domains. Take classroom management, for example. A revered or even feared teacher holds up her hand as if to say, "Stop," and the class falls silent. She does not need to speak, much less plead. She is in charge. There is no power struggle. We would, of course, be shocked to witness a student gesturing for his teacher to stop talking or to sit down. A student verbally interrupting the teacher is, however, less jarring because the student's awareness of the status dynamic is not so corrupted as to believe that his teacher will heed a nonverbal command. Any parent will instantly relate to how this plays out with their own children. The less the parent has to say to correct her child's behavior, the greater her authority in the relationship. If a mother's stern look is all that is required for her child to take her feet off the couch, she has a different relationship with her child than the parent whose child ignores her look of disapproval, displays obvious annoyance, or erupts in backtalk. A child's refusal to comply altogether with the parent's will, despite multiple, increasingly louder requests, makes it quite clear who is really in charge. Accordingly, a person may become infuriated when someone of lower status gives him a nonverbal command, such as raising a pointer finger midair as if to say, "Shush," or "Wait," pointing a finger at him as if to say, "Hey, you," or gesturing for him to slow down while driving as if to say, "Listen to me." In fact, in any given interaction, the lower status person rarely points a finger at the other or others. Finger pointing indicates conviction and authority, as well as confidence in our position. Observe any two people speaking, even when you can't hear what they are saying, and the one who is pointing is the one with the power, or who feels empowered because he believes he holds the higher moral ground. Inward or outward focus. Here's the scene. You witness one person march into the office of another. She closes the door so you cannot make out her question. You do, however, overhear the response, which is either, response A, "What are you talking about?" Or response B, "I don't know what you're talking about." If you were to guess, which response would indicate that person sitting in the office is of a higher status than the one who marched into it? Don't feel bad if you get it wrong. Most people do. Response A indicates a person of higher status. It's counterintuitive, explains psychologist James Pennebaker, that people who have power tend to use I, me, and my fewer times than do those of lower status. This is because pronouns signal our focus. We become self-oriented when we feel insecure and defensive, and we are outwardly oriented when we feel empowered and in control. Our perception of status leaks through subtleties in even the briefest exchanges and interactions. Consider the difference between "you should know" and "I would like you to know." "You should know" comes from a place of high status because it is A, outwardly focused, and B, worded as a fact, that is, you should know something. By contrast, the second phrase implies said information is not necessary for you to know, but it is something that I would like to share with you. The focus is on my needs, not yours. Let's take an example of two short text messages to see how so many indications can be packed into so few words. Response A. "Good morning, and forgive the delay in getting back to you. Agreed. It looks good. Nice job." Response B. "Good morning. I'm so sorry for my delay in getting back to you. Please accept my apology." "I agree. I think it looks great. Thank you." In the first text, we're hearing from a person who feels she has the power. She doesn't take ownership of the delay or, for that matter, offer an apology. Rather, she instructs the recipients to do something for her. Forgive the delay. There's a substantive difference between "I'm so sorry" and "forgive the delay." "I'm so sorry" takes ownership of the harm caused, whereas "forgive the delay," without adding "I'm sorry," is nothing more than a request of the other person with zero acknowledgement of personal wrongdoing. Let's take another example. Turning down the hallway, person A bumps into an innocent and jolted person B of equal professional status. Person A says, "I'm sorry," and person B says, "Excuse me." "Excuse me" is passive rather than active, diluting ownership. It puts the self second, outwardly focused, and makes a request of the listener. "I want you to do something for me, to excuse me," a tacit signal of power. Further proof is that you can facetiously say, "Excuse me," because it is an innately inauthentic apology. In contrast, "I'm sorry" cannot be said mockingly, barring extreme theatrics, because the active voice and the I ownership inherently convey sincerity. Although either phrasing is proper and preferred over "Watch where you're going, Buster," each hallway muttering reveals something about the individual's personality, assuming a pattern of this syntax, and the relationship dynamic. Either person A is more willing to assume personal responsibility for his actions, an indication of good mental health, or he may suffer from feelings of inferiority and is quick to take blame, an indication of poor mental health. We can't gauge either person's emotional health based on this exchange, but if we knew a little more about each person's station in life, we'd learn much more from this simple interaction. Should this same scene unfold with a 4-star general bumping into a new cadet, we might be surprised to hear the general say, "I'm sorry," and the cadet offer up, "Excuse me." The focus of an emotionally healthy cadet should move reflexively inward to produce a self-focused apology, such as, "I'm so sorry." But again, not always. "Excuse me, sir," might also be appropriate, and once again, may foreshadow something about the cadet. Yet, if we up the ante, whereby the cadet spills his drink on the general, then "Excuse me, sir," no longer suffices. We would expect an effusive first-person apology from the cadet, and its absence points to his warped perception of status and invites inquiry into his emotional health. We can also rely on a strikingly accurate visual cue, the direction of someone's head tilt. When a person feels ashamed because of his actions or rebuke, you'll note that his head tilts slightly downward. It's an indication that he is contrite, signaling submission. If, however, his chin tilts upward, He is feeling defiant and is unlikely to back down apologetically. You'll notice this instinctual reaction with children. When a small child is chastised, his head goes down. Similarly, in response to a false assumption or accusation, most emotionally healthy adults will display a slight head tilt upward, indicating that they have taken offense, as if to say, "What are you talking about?" In part three, we will return to our accident-prone cadet and discover how personality types and pathologies are observed through interactions, not only with other people, but also with inanimate objects. Because there is quite a difference between the person who says, "I can't open the window," the one who says, "The window is stuck," and the one who says, "The window is broken." Up next, we will continue to learn how to read a person within a specific situation itself. Here, you'll discover what calm and confidence look like, and how anger and anxiety leak out in subtle ways.